Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Paul Hill. He's a full-time investor, equity analyst. He's got his brain around more stocks than we've had hot dinners. Unbelievable. I don't know how you keep up with that, Paul, because I often said, for a while back, I had option paralysis, you know, too many stocks. When I started, I didn't know where to look. There's big caps, small caps, there's overseas, and I'm amazed how you can keep track of so many stocks being an analyst then.
Well, I'm hopeless compared to Paul Scott, who I spoke to at the weekend, who's a sort of like a real expert at sort of all things small cap, and I interviewed him, so I'd encourage everybody to have a look at that. But he said, he told me, I mean, he looks at a regular basis 500 stocks. And
I said to him, you can't monitor 500 stocks. How do you do that?
I said to him, do you ever sleep? And he says, well, I've been tracking them for like 15 years, so I've got a lot of history.
Okay. I see. So
Yeah, but he's basically a walking library on all things AIM and small cap. So he was brilliant to talk to, and he's got some great ideas. Both,
you know, I watched that. And do you know what was one thing I would say? Is I still find that even if you've built up knowledge, you know, because I've been in the markets for like 20 years and probably the last 10 years, I suppose. But I got to this point where I thought I need to specialise. I've dabbled. I started off with big caps. I think most people do that. Well, at this day and age, it's probably crypto and all that stuff. But most people start with, you know, big caps. And I sort of, you know, there's more gains to be had in the smaller cap space. They're more volatile, though. But then I needed to specialise a bit, you know, because I thought there's so many opportunities. Like you say, you get companies like, for example, Boohoo, that's dropped, for example. There's a play there. But I thought I've got to limit myself and be disciplined and try and specialise in an area I like, I find quite exciting, and I can get a handle on. And so I sort of gravitated towards smaller micro caps, you know. And so that way, setting up a filter and strategy, I can sort of reduce the risk in some way, you know, and get the good gains. But yeah, I find it really hard. I mean, that's one of the things about the market, is having too many options. It can make your decisions poor, because you can think, oh, should I do that? Yeah, because I see so many options on Twitter all the time. It's like, this has dropped off. That's a good company. It's right. You see these big companies like Boohoo, for example. There's opportunity there, but you've got to limit your, you know, you can't be a capital into everything. Can you? And I was surprised how many stocks he held. And the percentage he held in any one stock, I thought, how do you make a gain off that? You know, so
he's done really well over the time, so it works for him. But I would say your strategy of sticking to your knitting, only invest in areas that you've got deep expertise, definitely is the thing to do, no doubt about it. Albeit the overlay for that is that you've got to look at sufficient areas to give yourself diversification or some level of diversification. Because if you decide, let's say, for instance, I'm just going to be an expert in all things EV. Well, that's great if electric vehicles do really, really well. But frankly, you know, at some point in time, they'll have a wobble or whatever it is. And therefore, all your portfolio, if you've only invested in that, will come down. And that's, again, fine if you can take that level of volatility and risk, i.e. see a drawdown of 50 or 60% on your total portfolio. So I would say is such that, yes, invest in things you know you are comfortable in. And that's the Warren Buffett, you know, way, and certainly yours and mine as well. But give yourself sufficient breadth of knowledge of those areas to give yourself some diversification. And leading on to that, I you know, I've gone numerous ways. I started in big caps, I went into small caps, and now I do the whole lot, both the UK, US, and Europe. And the reason that is because there's opportunities everywhere across different sectors and in different size companies. And I'll just give you an example. I mean, yesterday, one of the companies, I mean, you'll yawn, but one of the companies that I own, Aviva, reported results. And they're just doing what they said they would do, you know, 18 months ago, the new CEO, Amanda Blond, said she was basically going to restructure the business. She sold off a lot of her foreign companies. They're focusing on the UK, Canada and Ireland now, rather than places in Europe and Singapore and Asia and all these kind of other places. And she's got sort of like a, you know, she's managed to collect £7.5 billion, and she's got over £4 billion, probably £5 billion of surplus capital. And just to give you an indication, £4 billion is roughly around about £1 a share, just over. The shares are currently just over £4. So you've got another £1 coming back to shareholders in either probably buybacks or some sort of form of dividend. And they've got an activist investor in there called Civian, who realizes actually you can squeeze this lemon even further. Oh, it's not, we shouldn't have called it a lemon. Just squeeze this orange a bit further, and they want £5 billion back to shareholders. That's another 25p. So this has really been a bit of a no-brainer for, you know, and I talked about it nine or 12 months ago when I bought it, and it's been tracking up. I bought it around about £2.60, and it's about £4. It's paid really good dividends since then. It's approaching fair value, so I'll probably sort of like drop out of it late, you know, over the next 6 months. But I think they're still going to the key going forward, and if investors are in there at the moment, the key going forward is to improve the return on equity. It's about 8% at the half year. If you reduce the capital base with a surplus capital return of £4 billion, you should be able to push the return on equity from 8% at the half year to around about sort of 13%. And if you can do that, that's going forward on a higher profit number by reducing the cost base as well. And therefore, you should be able to track up easily to your sort of, your net tangible book or your your book value, which is about, you know, £4.50 or £5. And so on that basis, there's still plenty of juice left in Aviva. So I'm happy to hold. But if I do see other opportunities, given it's a liquidity, you know, I'll use it as an ATM. I'll just use it as I'll sound the register and move on. So yeah. Coming back to your.
I mean, when you say that, though, I mean, I like your. I always love your stats and facts and see what you're looking at. The metrics that mean a lot to you. I like that a lot. But I mean, I'm not an expert in EV. I look at the way I filter is basically I will look for hot trends. Hot mega trends are going to last for a long time. I mean, the biggest at the moment is the energy transition. I'm looking into that. I'm very excited about that.
Okay, here's a question for you. Just on your EV expertise.
I haven't got any.
It's a bit of a trick question because you haven't yet seen the answer, but I don't know. What is the projected addressable market for electric vehicles in 10 years' time?
The total addressable market in 10 years' time. Are they saying that I knew there's a figure of they wanted to get like 30% by 2030 was the figure that EVs were pushing for. I think it's at about 3-4%, isn't it? Maybe top was 5%.
Yes, that's you're right. Yeah, you're getting closer there. Yeah, but no, in money terms, in value terms.
Oh, I don't know in money terms. I have no idea.
Okay, well, I recommend you and all the other investors who are sort of like want to talk about with the electric vehicles. I did an interview, which hasn't yet been published, I don't think, but it's with a super smart tech and software guy from Wedbush Securities. It's the latest edition of Voice on Wall Street. Anyway, it's a guy called Dan Ives. He's absolutely brilliant, but he loves EV and also Tesla. And he took me through the whole thing. And the answer to the question is $5 trillion. $5 trillion, I'll repeat that. And he says Tesla currently has got an 80% market share in the US of electric vehicles. You rightly point out this is the number one.
Yeah. Well, do you want a big figure? Do you want a big figure than that? Listen to this. This is Bloomberg's. And they're saying to achieve net zero carbon emissions by 2050 will require $173 trillion dollars of investment in the energy transition. That's how much is going into it. And I'm looking at EVs, I mean, you know, green hydrogen, all that stuff. I mean, that's a very exciting area. Because, I mean, the only thing holding it back at the moment is cost, but that will come down, you know, because it has to. And the investment going down is phenomenal. And they're saying that even by sort of, they reckon in their green scenario, they reckon it'll be sort of, it'll probably 70% of energy will come from, you know, sort of solar, wind, green hydrogen by 2050. So that's a huge, and if you look at the graphs on something like green hydrogen, phenomenal amount of demand, and all the big players are getting into it. I mean, you talk about, you know, Ineos, Shell every day are doing something about green hydrogen. So I think if anything, and it benefits green hydrogen, benefits sort of HGVs. It's funny looking at Elon Musk talking about trucks and stuff. I know he's been quite slow on that because it doesn't benefit batteries. Their power density doesn't benefit big vehicles.
Yeah,
so trains and HGVs, it works with hydrogen because you fill it up at the same time you can have with diesel, and it's the same power density as diesel pretty much, which batteries is not. You need a lot more space, and therefore more space is heavier, taking up more cargo space. So, yeah, it's worth looking. So, I mean, just saying the energy transition alone is the biggest. But, I mean, it's the end of the planet, according to some people, of course. So it's got to be. It's the biggest trend around. So I think as far as exposure is concerned, you've got to try and get some exposure to this area because it's going to be massive for years to come, you know. And so that's why
One way of getting exposure, and they came out with an acquisition yesterday. I don't know if you saw it. It was Saeta.
Yes, I saw that. Very interesting.
It's steel, wasn't it?
I saw the cheapness of that. I thought, wow, it's a steel.
Well, I'll tell you. I mean, basically, they do. So they're bread and butter is sort of next generation axial flux electric motors for sort of like two or three wheeler tuk-tuks and e-bikes and, you know, small vehicles out in Asia, largely India and China, because that's where they really, really need this sort of stuff. But they also, they did a trading update last month. They basically talked also, they've got really excited about electric outboard motorboats for, you know, engines for motorboats, plus for high performance cars. I mean, they can outrun, when they put these in-wheel, electric wheel things into Bugattis, they can outrun the fastest Lamborghini. So yeah, these things are absolutely brilliant. And also, you know, they've been basically looking at other bits and pieces they can do the electric vehicle. They're doing, that's right, I was just trying to remember, they're doing the new replacement in London for the transit van for InterCity. Wow. So they've got lots of different fingers in pies. Now, yesterday, this is the steel acquisition they did. And this is really good because it brings a sort of investing principle to all, you know, all people who are interested. Never become a distressed seller.
No.
Because Neil Woodford found out the pain 2 years ago.
Well, I didn't realise it was the Evergrande thing. I didn't realise it was connected until I read your article.
Yes.
Is that Evergrande? It's connected. I read your article on it, yeah.
Evergrande, basically the property developer out in China, it's the largest one. It's been swamped under $300 billion of debt, frantically trying to sort of like, you know,
sell everything. Buy this office quick.
Yeah,
we need
exactly.
cash. You know.
It owns about 64% of Evergrande. It's basically new energy automotive, which is listed in Hong Kong. So it owns that. And it's basically, over the last 12 months, it's been putting huge pressure on that subsidiary to return cash. Now, unfortunately, Evergrande New Energy has got so short of cash that it actually can't pay its employees either. So it's had to do a fire sale of one of its Dutch companies called E-Traction. And just luckily, Saeta knows this really well. It's already been looking at in-wheel electric motors for sort of heavier duty vehicles, for sort of buses and for HGVs and stuff, having a part. So it had already done the due diligence, this company. It comes up for sale. They can effectively, on a fire sale, it's going to go, you know, if they're not careful, it will go into administration. They can pick it up immediately. So it works both ways for both parties. So it's a great acquisition. So having done the two or three wheelers, high performance cars, the potential transit, it's now got the technology to do electric powertrains and in-wheel electric motors for larger vehicles, for HGVs, for trucks, and for buses. He's got the whole shebang. Mm. And for two million,
I was going to say, did they suggest how much it would be? Because I can imagine the panic in Evergrande. They're just trying to sell everything. They don't mind if they're probably taking hundreds of the price. You know, taking massive haircuts on everything, aren't they? Just got it. They need cash desperately. So bargains galore from that company. Yeah. You know?
Yeah, look, I mean, I would encourage anybody to have a look at the portfolio of Evergrande and see whether you can think about a house in Beijing going cheap.
Yeah, yeah. And sort of
a contact million than it was before. But that was a great acquisition. And again, it just shows you the nimbleness of the management team. Mm. I mean, I've interviewed the guys a couple of times, Vic Kiss, the CEO, and I was so impressed by how he was looking at it. And also, I mean, also just look at the endorsements by the shareholders. I mean, when you get going into that IPO, which there was about, I don't know, it was only done a couple of, you know, 3 or 4 months ago, but when you get the likes of Andy Brough, Paul Jordan, you get Guy Feld from Hargreave, you know, basically Hargreave Hale or Canaccord, and there's another guy who's also equally brilliant in there as well. So when you get that quality of shareholder who put their hard cash into a business like this, you know that all the pieces are there. And hey, surprise, surprise, from their IPO price, and I think it was probably about, was it 120 or something like that, if I remember rightly? They're already over £2. But if you run the maths and they get 5% of this sort of like, you know, sort of electric vehicle market, you know, in spite of the 10 years, you see this at £10-12. So again, there's plenty of sort of like firepower behind that one. So yeah, EVs are looking really good.
Yeah. I mean, I think all that area, anything, I mean, if you haven't got, so like I said, I don't see diversity as in size of company. I see it as in sectors, you know, and like I said, my portfolio, I've got sort of exposure to sort of gaming, esports, you know, fintech, medtech, experiential leisure, which is very growing because you've got, you know, literally, The kids grow up today are aware of the climate. They're not buying sort of just plastic tat if they can help it. They prefer to go on an experiential leisure, for example. I don't know if you saw this, Escape Hunt, but experiential leisure is growing very quickly. And people want to get out there, take pictures of social media and all that stuff, show off and do stuff, you know, and create memories rather than just buying tat that's going to kill the climate. Did you see the acquisition that Escape Hunt did of Boom Battle Bar, which is quite nice?
What was the logic behind that one?
Well, essentially, you know, for a long time, Richard and the guys have been talking about there's sites in the pipeline. There's Escape Hunt on 19 sites so far. The EBITDA sort of cash positive at 15 to 17. But they said, we are looking at sites and, you know, it's going to be mentioned sooner or later. And everyone kept saying, when's the new sites coming? And everyone expected to say maybe up to 5 sites announcing one go. And they came up with the acquisition of Boom Battle Bar, which the guys behind Flip Out, Flip Out is a trampoline park. My kids go there every pretty much week. It's always busy, but they have 50 sites slip out already, but the guys behind that, and it's kind of like a social competitive gaming bar. So there's crazy golf, there's all the darts, there's axe throwing, plus there's cocktail street food. It's done very well, you know? That catches all the marketing. It's a very novelty thing, and you're caged in, it's very safe and all that stuff. You can't be drinking when you're doing it, but it's very safe. But they've got 21 modular games they fit into these, you know, into these bars, and they're massive. So they came up with this acquisition. Straight away, the pipeline went to 21 sites, new sites, on top of their 19. And they've got a further pipeline of 39 sites there. And most of these Boom Battle Bars are franchisees groups. By the way, they got capital contributions from landlords of 12.6 million. This is going to be profitable in the first half of next year. 18 sites already been signed up by franchisees. Alex, they're just rolling these out so quickly. The demand is massive. And my friend has been the one in Cardiff. He said, I see the future of bars. He said, rather than just, you know, looking to do something, then go to a bar and drink, you just go there with your mates, play games, and everything from pool to bulls, there's loads of different games. But it's very exciting. They've got two massive sites as well. We're talking like 17,000 square foot, one in the centre of Oxford Street, one in the O2, it's opening very soon. And there's one in Hull, 34,000 square feet. There'll be a flip out, a Boom Battle Bar, and escape room. And so there's lots of shared costs. In fact, there's hardly any cost for escape now. And it makes sense because before they had small reception areas, escape rooms with a couple of snacks. Now they've got a proper bar in there, you know, games, drinks, everything. So, and Richard said on the podcast, I recorded a podcast with him this week, said he sees this as an opportunity to create the UK's most preeminent experiential leisure group. And after that, we go further afield. And of course, there's franchisees happening in the US as well. I see it's becoming a big company. The guys behind Escape Hunt are clever. Richard was the chief strategy guy at Pret a Manger, rolling those out. Another guy there was created Giraffe Restaurant, sold to Tesco. The guys behind Boom Battle Bars did Flip Out. There's a huge amount of wealth and talent in Escape Hunt now, and they've got plenty of cash. And I see it very exciting. You know, it's just transformed the business overnight. I mean, no one saw 39 new sites coming online like that. And yeah, it's phenomenal. I think it's been a really exciting.
You keeping your 3% in it, aren't it? Are you
not
changing your whole?
I'd be too overexposed in the portfolio if I do that. So I can't. So I've still got, you know, 3 million shares in there at the moment. So
Add to the play in the placing? No.
No, I'm going to take up. So is it part of the placing and all that? There's a 12 on open offer. I'll take up the open offer probably, but. I can't, it's just having to balance that portfolio. It's my biggest holding now anyway, so I don't want to go bananas on it. But part of me thinks, maybe I just should. I've got a lot of confidence in it, but you've always got to realise there's always risks. So, you know, so I won't go absolutely berserk. I've got, you know, sort of six stocks I've got. So, I'm happy with the balance for the moment. But no, yeah, very exciting, very exciting that is.
Yeah, as I say, you've just got to get the right level of diversification and you know, sort of like, you know, that you want personally. I mean, another one, which is a big cap sort of like, and they say, you know, the large companies don't gallop, but AstraZeneca is. I mean, I only bought it sort of like 6-9 months ago. It's up 25%. And the key learn, they put out sort of like Q3 results this morning, and I was just sort of flicking through it. But really, for the big picture, for the sort of principle for investors here, is that actually the shares are up, you know, as I say, 25%, but they're cheaper now than they were when I bought them 6 to 9 months ago. And that's because the earnings have accelerated, the outlook and the earnings have improved faster than the shares have. So they're actually, they're on about 18 times earnings for next year, but they're growing that sort of level again, about high, you know, sort of teens next year. So it's about, they've got a peg ratio of about 1, which for a top quality, you know, immunotherapy business for oncology is just absolutely great. And it just bought Axelion as well, which has got rare diseases. It does sort of like, you know, That one does rare diseases. The other ones it's got is sort of cardiovascular, et cetera. And it's just set up a separate division for its COVID vaccine and for its antibodies, you know, sort of body. So it's the most valuable, biggest company on the FTSE. But this one could keep powering ahead for years. I mean, they're going to carry on. The sort of the 5-year outlook for earnings is high double digits, if not, you know, sort of like 20%+ increase in EPS for the next 5 years. So I think this one has still got, I mean, I said that when I bought it, this could be £150 a share, you know, stock quite easily.
When did you buy it? I remember you buying it. We thought, well,
I bought it about, I don't know, just, it was about 70 quid, I think it was, about six months ago. You get a nice dividend. But again, I'll just say these kind of things, if you're just looking for a steady eddy type of, you know, sort of low risk, on the running on the coattails of large, big global themes, i.e. cancer, immunotherapy, infectious diseases. This one's, I mean, you can't miss it. It's right at the top of the FTSE. And it's cheap. At a peg ratio of 1, this is cheap for such a IPR-rich healthcare giant, absolute giant. And it's...
I remember you buying it and us saying these kind of plays like this when it was oversold a little bit, you know, and it was down and dumps hitting sort of support levels. It's almost sometimes when you get companies like this, you can almost close your eyes and just buy it. You know, think over time it'll be fine. It's just having one of those temporary sell-offs. Because when these big stocks start having sell-offs, it's like a tanker. It takes a while to turn around the momentum. Selling begets selling, and that's when you can take advantage, isn't it? And it will take a couple of months to grind lower. It's like same with Boo and ASOS and all that, because those companies, it'll take a while, but you know, looking back in a year's time, I think that was a buy opportunity, you know, those kind of companies there, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I'll just give you the numbers. I mean, in 2023, I reckon they'll do $8.60, which if you divide by you know, sort of the, you know, the exchange rate, 135, you get sort of £6.37 or £6.35, say, and it's on, what, 95 quid now. So divide by sort of like £6.35. Yeah, hang on, just doing it now. Divided by £6.35.
You do it in your head, Paul,
That's 15 times PE. I mean, it's just, and they'll be growing earnings. So it just, you just look at it and you just think, well, this is a no-brainer, really. Because the visibility over the next 10 years of earnings is great. So, anyway, I mean, I'm happy with both of those big caps. Really, really good. I mean, moving on, I mean, I know you're going to chat to the guy. Oh, you did chat to them. How did you get on with Manolay? I was going to say, with Stephen.
No, it's very nice, Steve. You know, and what I like is someone, I've spoken to a lot of CEOs, you know, and you know where there's spin happening and they're trying not to tell you. Steve is very down to earth and he will tell you exactly how it is. Like you said, you know, they did very well during the lockdown considering, you know, they couldn't go about their normal business.
It was still profitable. Did you see that the margins was, I mean, the EBIT margins were still 30%.
Yeah.
So, you know.
I mean, just to explain, you probably need to explain what Manolay is. Some people don't understand what they're about. So just to give a top line for people.
I mean, basically, Manolay are the UK's number one insolvency litigation funder. So basically, they take cases. They buy all, you know, 90% of their cases they work on, they buy from insolvency practitioners. And during the last 12 to 18 months, the government has imposed unprecedented sort of conditions on the industry to stop the courts processing insolvencies for businesses and for individuals. But they lifted that embargo on the 1st of October. And so consequently, what happened is that from when that law was put into place in June of 2020, it depressed artificially the level of insolvencies, surprise, surprise, for about sort of like, 9 to 12 months. But then you saw coming into this sort of like the withdrawal of those sort of like unprecedented creditor protections on the 1st of October. The last 6 months, you've seen an increase in the number of insolvencies and the number of creditor voluntary liquidations, and so consequently, and that's really the bread and butter for Manolay. And
what I thought was quite interesting there, that you say depressed this. You've got two drivers here essentially. You've got the normal, you know, run rate of the business was suppressed. Now it's going back to normal. And now they've got a sharp increase as well, because, of course, you know, the pandemic will create more insolvencies and more problems. So the business will be busier. I mean, did Steve say there will be a bit of a lag before all this comes into play? But it's going to happen. We're seeing a sharp increase, you know, in
case inquiries. Yeah, you're already seeing it through the stats. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if anybody wants to download the presentation, I think it's on the Vox website, actually.
Yeah, no, he did a presentation as well. It's on there. And also, what I quite like is he's, two things. He said, first of all, we're specialists and, you know, this is all we deal in. We know exactly what we're doing here, and we only have to send a letter sometimes. I don't know what percentage it was, quite high. Doesn't even get to court. We send a letter to them, they understand straight away what's going on, and they settle.
I mean basically it's over 95% of all court, of all cases get settled out of court. So you know, I mean, and the chart to have a look at is this one.
Go on.
I don't know if you can see it. It basically, anyway, it shows you that the level of insolvencies, it's chart, what is it? I'm trying to look at it. Has it got a number? Oh, it has a small one. Yeah, 13, chart 13. And it just shows you the industry. And it's now above pre-pandemic levels for the level of creditor voluntary liquidations. That's going to drive the revenues. And I just to give you a level of sort of value, I mean, you know, they were profitable even during unprecedented sort of conditions over the last 12 months. That's now sort of gone. I think they could easily do 15 million of EBIT in a couple of years time, or, you know, 2024, etc. On that basis, 14 times multiple, you get the share price of roughly around about, you know, £4.40 compared to less than £3 currently. But actually, I think they could beat the £15 quite easily, given the positive operating leverage. Stephen, I mean, when you spoke to him, I guess, I don't know if he told you, he did in the announcement anyway, but he's increasing capacity because he really believes he needs some more feet on the street to be able to process the huge backlog of cases that are coming his way. And just to give you an indication, they've got, you know, that of this market of third-party purchasing of insolvency, of IP insolvency cases, they've got a huge market share. It's well over 50% of it. So they dominate it. They've got the best database. They've got the best experienced lawyers in-house. And therefore, when it comes to pricing risk of these sort of cases, they can do it better than anybody else. And it's a win-win as well, because it helps the creditors. It helps the insolvency practitioners, because they haven't got to take the risk. It even helps the, you know, sort of defendant, because it means he hasn't got to go to prison. So it's a win-win-win. And obviously it helps, they're doing work as well. So it's a better reallocation of capital. It saves as many jobs as it can do, and it moves things forward rather than getting stuck in a sort of insolvency loop, which is what used to happen before this. What they're doing was, you know, sort of like given the green light by the government. So, yeah. I mean, it's, all I would say is that, you know, I think this one, again, is, it's a bit of a no-brainer. It's a small
And what I like as well, I mean, I don't know if you've that book about that studies, companies have done 100 bags, and they said there's no real theme, but one of the strong themes was companies that are founded and, you know, and the founder has a big chunk of shares tend to do very well compared to, you know, companies where, and Steve owns, I think, about 15% of the stock, and he founded this, like I said, 2009 there. So, yeah, so... You know, he's fully invested, and
he's got plenty of skin in the game. And another one with plenty of skin in the game, well, I think you've spoken to in the past, but maybe you didn't this week, is one of my favourites, Sukh Chamdal.
I did a presentation with him last night. Webinar with him last night. And
Did you? Oh, okay.
Yeah, lovely guys. Worth checking out there. They did a webinar. They did a presentation and some Q&A afterwards. And
What did you make of the results?
It's amazing. It's, you know, to me, it's one of those no-brainers. They got people wanting franchisees. I don't know, the number was huge. Like, I think it was 50 or 60 people.
62.
Yeah, 62 people queuing up to take franchisees off them. They're in Asda. Asda got like 650 stores across the UK. Once you get into those spaces like that, you know, it's very sticky, isn't it? And it seems to me, it almost seems to be they can't get enough sites they want to. It's demand day, just getting the sites, isn't it, really? You know, and it'll roll out.
Well, I mean, I know what I'd say is if anybody hasn't put some money into it, is interested in investing in sort of like, you know, the UK's go-to provider for sort of like egg-free celebration cakes, which is what Cake Box is, and it's a great brand. If anybody wants to sort of like check it out, just go to one of their, you know, franchisee store and try it. I mean, I did, yeah? You know, did the secret shopper in August with my father on the 80th birthday, and the product was just unbelievable for people who were, you know, at the end of the meal, etc., who were really discerning customers. I mean, basically, my wife, I mean, she doesn't do it, but she's almost a professional cook when it comes to cake. She's absolutely brilliant. She couldn't. Yeah, you know, it was flabbergasting. She was chuffed a bit. Well, she thought it was excellent. And her mum, my mother-in-law, she wasn't there. So Anne brought some pieces back for her, and she was chomping in into the cake for a week. I mean, she absolutely loved it. So all I would say is that if you've got any doubt, just go to the local store and just try the product yourself out and see what you think. And I the shares have done really, really well since IPOing about 2 or 3 years ago. I think they IPO'd about just over £1, £1.10. Yeah. £4. But I actually think when you ran the numbers, I think the sales for this business could hit 65 million in about 5 years' time. You put a 22% EBIT margin on that, which is 22. They do 22% currently, so it's not massively stretched. And on that basis, you get a share price of over £7. So, you know, there's plenty of juice still left in that, in the Cake Box shop. And as I say, it's a very successful rollout of a really good concept. The key, though, when you look, you know, the key is that is that double team between Sukh, who's the brains and the sort of like the heart of the business.
And the salesman, question. He sold me straight away. The first question he sold me, I said, Sukh, stop talking about cake, please, because I'm dying for a cake. Yeah, and you really go, and the roles fit them, you know. It's like he's founder and salesman, and CFO is very straight laced, and
No, you got Sukh, who's basically the creative heart of the old business, and just loves the product and wants to have a fantastic service. You can just see it all, you know, throughout his body. And then you've got Pardip Das, the CFO, who's just basically the financial whiz, the brains behind the whole sort of like, you know, rollout of franchises and making sure there's enough, there's obviously enough money and capital. And I mean, the cash is just piling up and they're still rolling out lots and lots of stores. So, you know, he's doing a fabulous job as well.
Well, they did say they're going to invest a bit more in like marketing because they've been very low level in marketing, but doing very well. But I said, do you know what? What you should advertise for is a chief cake tester. That would get national headlines, and you know, you'd be people queuing on the block.
That'd
for
be
that.
A great idea.
I know, but no, very simple. And in fact, what, you know, what, do you know one of my stocks, which is funny, I hold. They got results out on Monday, and this company was written off for a long time. And in fact, people talked to me about it years ago, and the old management used to burn lots of money, and it's Gfinity. And I really like what John Clark, the CEO, has done. And these turnaround plays are quite good. I quite look like this, because he came on the podcast three times saying we're going to be profitable, EBITDA profitable, in the next year. And I didn't really believe him, because it was tainted with the old management. There was a lot of cash burn. And he's driven now towards higher margin business, which is digital media, their software as a service, because their esports platform is white labeled for any sort of esports competitions around the world. It's one of the best. And I think on Monday, expectations of 5.5 million, up 21%. This is just a start, but the margins will be a lot higher. And they're looking at top line, they're forecasting top line compound annual growth to 2024 of 48%. And, and just looking at what they do, they acquire these sites that have niche following and they sort of optimize them, they advertise on them, they grow them as well, they grow the user number and the value per user. And so, for example, they acquired this company called this site called Epic Streams, and it's a very sort of geeky website in December. It had like 500,000 users in December. It's now just hit 3.5 million in October. So the growth of that's now with advertising and all that stuff. So I think John Clark and the team, they've done amazing, but it's just a start. I mean, at the moment, they're not cheap. They're going to go for 10 times sales, but they will go to 5 times or 4.5 times sales based on next year's forecast, and the growth is phenomenal. So they will grow into that, and they're doing the right thing, you know, so I'm really impressed. So these guys turn around players.
When I listen to you now, over this last 18 months, you impress me even more.
It's you.
You overlay that valuation. You say, well, they're not cheap. They're on like 10 times sales. And you're absolutely spot on. They're not that isn't
no,
cheap.
But if you look at in the US, I mean, this is like now going to be EBITDA profitable. If you look at the US esports gaming companies, they're like on ridiculous multiples. They're nowhere near any kind of profit at all.
But you look at the point I'm making. Is that you're looking at those metrics to get that guide to see how other investors will look at it and perceive it and valuation rather than just ignoring valuation. Now you need to put on sort of like your EBITDA multiples and EBIT multiples and all that kind of stuff, depending on how early stage the company is. If it hasn't got profits, you can't do it anyway. But
I've got all that in a spreadsheet, but you are the spreadsheet genius, and I've learned from you there. And it's one of those things that they've got huge amount of growth coming forward, you know, and their sites are getting better all the time. And there's a wealth of talent behind them, and the content they create is very good. And like I said, they've done the right thing, focusing on, because before they were the old management, they were a service provider to big brands for esports companies. They still do that now, but they won't do it unless it makes economic sense. Before, they just did it because they hooked up with like Formula One and all these big names. But now they supply the software as a service. They've got the the digital media arm as well, which is a high margin, and so it makes a lot more sense. So it's one of those ones. The share price is frustrating because I got in at I think 1.5 pence. It's now 4.5 pence. It's done very well, but it's gone nowhere. It's gone up and down in the last year, and so it's been frustrating. But it will go again. You know, you just have to have a bit of patience. You know, that's it until it grows into that sort of. You know, thing, but it will. It's going to work. You know, it's just patience. You know, I've lacked on certain stocks, but I'm not going to lack on this because it could be. Their model, by the way, is Future PLC, and they've got a guy, non-executive director, on with them for Future. They've got ex-Apple guys. They've got a huge amount of experience in this team. So the share price of Future PLC is phenomenal. It's like wow. Digital media. Anyway, go on. What's next?
Basically, just updates on three other companies in the healthcare space. First of all, Bellascura. You know, I keep getting more and more impressed by this actual firm. They basically make portable oxygen concentrators, next generation ones. Anyway, they put a trading update about a week ago, and they upgraded their expectations for this year, next year, and the out years, etc. it's going to be, I mean, essentially by 2025, you've now got the house broker, Dowgate Capital, saying they're going to do sales of $111 million and an EBIT of EBITDA of $34 million. So that's a margin of nearly 31%. And they've lifted their price target to 150. The shares are about £1 currently. But I think, actually, if you look at things, how things should really go. I mean, I said when they IPO'd back in May that I thought the shares could get to, you know, sort of £1.80 to to 220p, you know, over the next 5 years. And I think that's very, very achievable, because I actually think, I mean, this is, you know, just to remind investors, a portable oxygen concentrator allows patients who have got breathing difficulties for whole numerous different conditions. It could be COVID, it could be COPD, it could be, you know, sort of like bronchial pneumonia, whatever it is like that, to have to be treated at home, to take all the resource away from the hospitals. And that's going to be one of, again, the huge themes going forward. We saw the stats. It was the first story on the BBC yesterday, was how the NHS is getting swamped, but they're not dissimilar to everywhere around the world. And therefore you can have more sort of like more thrust, more money being put into being able to treat people remotely through telemedicine, or alternatively at home, or giving them a better quality life through mobile. And essentially, these portable oxygen concentrators hit all of those. So, you know, they're really onto that sort of, they're going to be on the coattails of that tailwind across the whole of the industry. So it's a trend that it looks out for. And I say the two, you know, the management team, Bob Rauker and Tony Dyer, the CFO, I mean, they're doing a terrific job. And okay, it's an early stage, you know, company, but they're listed at 45p. They're about £1. And they could double again over the next 5 years. So, you know, they're hitting the ball out of the park on that one.
Yeah, they're busy, aren't they? I mean, I was seeing news coming out, and think the proper news coming out. Do you think that just shows demand there? Absolutely.
Oh, it's a huge demand, yeah. And that's what's driving the them to increase the expectations, is that basically the response when they've launched in the States has just been fantastic. Another one which is actually going to have a transitionary year, and I've talked a lot about it, but the shares have been sold off, and it just smells of buying opportunity, is Oncommune. And if people, you know, just to remind people what Oncommune done, it's got this sort of proprietary database of sort of like almost 9,000 autoimmune sort of like proteins, etc., that big pharma need to be able to sort of like help them with their drug discovery, and also for sort of like, you know, to do treatments and maybe even companion diagnostics going forward. But you've got the likes of Roche who are using them, Genentech, and companies of that ilk. If they can't do it in-house, it just is a huge endorsement of the actual business's IPR. And they're getting lots of more repeat orders. They've got an order book of sort of a pipeline of 190. I think when I interviewed the CEO, Adam Hill, about 2 weeks ago. So he's got a huge pipeline of potential orders he wants to sort of convert in. And the reason why I am really interested in this company, and I'll probably do some more work on it as much as anything, is that this could really be this year. They just put out a prelims a couple of weeks ago. This coming year could be transformational for them, because this is the year they could become profitable at the EBITDA level on sales of roughly around about, I think it was the brokers on about, the singers on about £12 million, if I remember. You know, they're just getting an increase, and they're spending more and more. They're putting more of the money into, you know, sort of like their customers, and to grow in the States as well. So this could be, a really, really profitable. And the reason why, you know, you've got all that operating leverage is the core part of the business, the ImmunoInsights service, which helps obviously all of these large farmers. Their EBITDA drop throughs. When I interviewed Adam, I mean, the EBITDA drop-throughs are over 80%. It's already, the business they have in Germany, in Dortmund, where the facility is already profitable. So once that continues to scale up, I mean, they did just less than £4 million of revenue last year, but they're going to do 12 this year. And that's the reason why you're going to drive that operating leverage. You're going to get, it becomes EBITDA positive. So this is a really, really high, you know, IPR rich business in, you know, healthcare, doing lots and lots of sort of like, you know, treating lots of big therapeutic areas, immunotherapy, infectious diseases, autoimmune diseases. But it's good. There's no other place, very few other places in the world who have that level of depth and quality of database. And it's getting bigger and deeper by the minute, because the more samples that they process for these large biopharma companies, the better and deeper the IPR becomes. So their barriers to entry become even greater. And these kind of things go for sort of 4 to 5 times book, you know, in terms of sort of like, not book, of R&D investment, et cetera. So when you run that those numbers, you get sort of like over £3.50, £4 a share, compared to, I think it's about £1.80, £1.70 or something like that at the moment. So, and Adam is great. And
yeah, you always suspect, though, when you get companies like this that are starting out, but they're very hot, you know, the full year results, they will take a knock, because generally you see some analysts who don't know anything about the company will just look at the top line, look at the valuation, and say, well, hang on a sec, that's 20 times or 25 times sales. What's going on there? But they don't understand that they're going to grow by 4 or 5 times that, you know, next year.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
So that's why, yeah.
And also, I think investors got a bit sort of spooked. They had a quiet first period over the summer because most of their customers actually went away on holiday. But when they came back, and this is what Adam was explaining, when they came back in September, they had a roaring pickup in the level of demand, and that's what they're sort of converting at the moment. So he sounded highly confident in how the business is performing, particularly that the key stat is 85% or 80% EBITDA drop through rates for that Immuno Insights business out in Germany, and it's already profitable. So they've got the blueprint. All you need now is to you know, keep priming the engine and rev it a bit further and get more throughput in, and it's up to the big sort of sales guys out in the States to bring those orders, to convert the pipeline, because the demand is massive. It's just a matter of getting it there. And and pricing's very firm on it. I mean, as in, like, you know, that everybody pays the same sort of price. And I think he was saying it's 1,000, if I remember rightly, 1,080 euros per sample tested. So it just shows you the opportunity there. And then the last one is a big pharma. I mean, I've already done Astra, but you know, I own Merck. You know, I've talked about that one. And the last time I gave you an update, and that they were the first big pharma to have one of their products, their antiviral for COVID, not approved, but come through clinical trials, 50%. Well, a week later, Pfizer came out with even better efficacy. And so I had a bit of a bath on that one. But the only reason why I do that is the best reason that I've ever come across to lose a shed load of money on a single day. If somebody has a competitor has a better antiviral that helps the world and saves hundreds of thousands of lives around the world, then you can't exactly complain, can you?
Your portfolio is taking the hit. There's bigger problems in the world, I know. Do you know what? Anything else I mentioned? I want to ask you one thing. I know you're not a fan of crypto. I think it's a house of cards right now, cryptocurrencies, because the valuation is absolutely crazy and ridiculous, and people try to justify it and all kinds of things. And I think maybe only Bitcoin justified, because it could be digital gold.
Why do you think there's such a divergence of opinion? Because you get some super smart investors who are just like absolutely loving it and really think, you know, I mean, Coinbase, I don't know what the valuation is, but it's absolutely massive. You know, some people think it's really the bee's knees, and it's the way it's going to always happen. It's going to happen. Then you get people like, you know, John Paulson, who's basically a, you know, big guy, and they asked him what he thinks of Bitcoin, and he says it's basically a limited supply of nothing. That was his view. Well, so you get this huge divergence.
Yeah, but also people have changed their mind. Like you're seeing, you know, JP Morgan's from the big banks have changed their mind, and they're hiring blockchain people, you know. So the people do come round, because when you think of it, even right now this week, the Bank of England doing more in-depth exploratory work into digital currencies. So we know digital currencies is going to be here, and pretty much we are in digital currencies. You pay in binary figures anyway, when you use a card online. So we know that they are here to stay, and maybe the decentralized technology is going to be here to stay. But I do see, like, the internet boom, you know, a lot of these companies won't exist in 10 years' time. And I did I don't know if you saw that on Twitter. I said, it's something like now at the moment, 100 of the biggest coins on market cap are above 1 billion in valuation. 100 of them, about a billion. Top 40 are above 5 billion. That's nuts, isn't it? I mean, that's FTSE 100 almost style size companies. They got no revenue, these companies. Nothing at all.
If you add up all the cryptocurrencies which are traded, yeah, do you know what value you get?
No.
It's bigger than Apple. It's $3 trillion worth of crypto. At the moment, I mean, I'm just trying to support what you're saying is that you've got a huge amount of, you know, sort of like faith in that sort of like level of, I mean, that's an enormous $3 trillion. It's just, frankly, massive.
Well, Bitcoin alone is 1.2 trillion. You know, Ethereum is half a trillion. And I'm thinking, okay, maybe there's an argument for Bitcoin being digital gold, because maybe moving from, you know, in this day and age, people don't store by gold or that. But there's a lot of these things that will start collapsing, I believe, and it'll bring the valuations down, like in the dot-com boom, and then at more sensible levels. But I was thinking, it's very interesting. If you want to get access to crypto in a more reasonable, valued way, it's probably worth playing an investment company. I mean, if I talked to Blue Star Capital in the week, and they're an investment company. They invest in esports and all high tech and gaming. But they've got a holding in Satoshi Pay, which is decentralized finance. The market cap of this company is only like 10 million. And Satoshi Pay, their Pendulum sort of investment, just raised 5 million it obviously depends how much they own of that. But if you want a measured way of access and exposure to this area, because it is a wild market. But do you think crypto is sucking money out of the main market? Do you reckon that's happening at the moment?
I think it's definitely sucked money out of the gold market. It's one of the reasons why the gold price has flattened, you know, even though inflation has been rocketing. We had that last week out of the States was a sort of 6% print, or was it this week? I can't remember, but it was an enormous number. But the gold hasn't really gone up, and the reason is because you know, people have been, the younger generation have been putting money into Bitcoin, so it's definitely taken out of sort of like, you know, the gold and those sort of like perceived as inflation.
Yeah, yeah, it's been
there
for a while. But gold has actually just had a rally last couple of, I mean, it's starting to move now. But it's been behind sort of, Bitcoin is seen as a play on sort of course, inflation. Maybe that's it. I don't know. But
I would say with Bitcoin, I don't think it's taken too much out of the stock market. In fact, I'd say it's put it in, because you look at Coinbase, I don't know what the market cap of Coinbase is, but it's frankly enormous. And you've got so many companies also like Argo blockchain and people like that. So it's added to the overall market cap of the market. The key, I mean, it's a battleground area, and you can argue it one way or another. I mean, I've spoken to some super smart investors who believe that it's really going to do, you know, marvelous. I personally wouldn't be putting my own money into it, but I can equally see, you know, if you do get the regulators giving it the green light, particularly in the States, Bank of England, elsewhere, etc., and you know, those particular sort of, you know, cryptocurrencies are used as, you know, as ways of exchanging money, then it will make sense. But and Coinbase will do brilliantly, because it is that platform to be able to convert across the relevant crypto assets. But hey, you know, you've got to have faith, and you've got to, you know, believe in it. And I was more sort of like a skeptic, but you know, sort of like 6 months ago. But I'm actually coming more along the lines of that maybe it will be you know, these areas there will be actual sort of profits to be made. But
it's just the ridiculousness of these meme coins, you know. And when you think that Dogecoin and then a spin-off, which is a dog essentially, that's 33 billion. You know, and you got Shiba Inu, which is a spin-off, because Dogecoin was ramped by Elon Musk. Someone decided, let's create another meme-based Dogecoin, and that's now at 28 billion. What's behind this? It's like, now this is the height of insanity, and people in it don't see it, of course, but I do see it as dot-com bubble. It may take a while to pop a little bit, but I think it's going to go, you know, it's going to go. So be careful if you think this. It is the technology, I believe, is the future, but not all of these are the future. It's like, you know, with Amazon, even during the dot-com boom, people thought Amazon was going bust. Where is it now? You know, there are opportunities to pick up some good opportunities.
Just to sort of finalise that one off, if people are interested in where there's opportunities, software, technology, you know, as I say, I'm not sure it's been published yet, but it'll be published later this morning. Have a look. I strongly recommend people watch, and you, Justin, because it'll tell you about EVs. they basically, when I speak to this guy, Dan Ives of Wedbush Securities, because he takes me through software and technology, not in the next 12 months, but in the next 5 years. Yeah. And the big themes, the golden themes that he talks about, the cloud, electric vehicles, digitization, and, you know, just general sort of software. And yeah. It's absolutely great. He puts firm numbers and cyber, that's it. And he'll take you through it. And you may, I mean, I'm a skeptic, and, you know, I'm a sort of like a bit of a cheapskate when it comes to sort of valuation. But he even convinced me that Tesla at a trillion dollar valuation is actually not that stupidly valued. And when he took me through it, it isn't.
Yeah,
it
but do you know what? What I heard is the reason why these EVs, Rivian, for example, 100 billion, no revenue listed. Yeah. One of the best things I heard was that, that could be thinking different level, was that if these batteries become so good, they become a store of energy for your house. So not only are you driving the car, it recharges, you go back, plug it into your house, you can sell that electricity through, or put that electricity through your house, even sell it to the grid, you know? So that's another concept I've never heard of. So that's interesting. So we don't know where, we know technology is amazing. It'll advance a lot faster. You know, technology enables exponential technology growth. So we don't know where it goes. So that's, how do you price that in? You know, that's what's happening with crypto as well, I suppose. Marvellous, Paul. Thanks for that, fella. And we'll speak in a fortnight.
Yeah, take care, Justin. Cheers, then.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loans subject to approval in available locations.
This podcast is sponsored by IQBar. Your favorite clean, functional, delicious nutrition brand is raising the bar with a little help from Thomas Keller, Michelin star chef of the French Laundry. IQBar and Thomas Keller have teamed up to create a salted caramel chip protein bar and yuzu mango hydration mix. With toasted macadamia nuts, rich caramel flavor, and brain-boosting nutrients, this bar is like having a Michelin star meal in your pocket. Pair it with the taste bud tingling yuzu mango IQ mix hydration mix, packed with magnesium and adaptogens to improve clarity and mood. With Keller's culinary excellence and IQ Bar's commitment to great taste and clean ingredients, this limited edition collaboration is simply mwah. And the best part is that 10% of sales go directly to Chef Keller's nonprofit, Mentor, that supports aspiring young chefs. Great taste, great nutrition, great mission. Go to IQBar.com today and enter promo code KELLER20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products plus free shipping. That's IQBAR.com, promo code KELLER20.